Take it from me, you guys are not going to want to miss the party of the summer. It's Rocklahoma, it's back in Pryor, Labor Day weekend, September 1st through 3rd, and it's going to feature acts like Warrant, LA Guns, Bullet Boys, Godsmack, Chevelle, Daughtry, Skid Row, Limp Bizkit, Bush, Theory of a Dead Man, Asking Alexandria, Kix, Pantera, Rob Zombie, Corey Taylor, and many, many more. Go to rocklahoma.com right now to get your weekend passes and keep listening to On the Road to Rock with me, Clint Switzer, to learn how you can win two weekend passes for the whole weekend of Rocklahoma. Stay tuned.
What's up, everybody? It's John Bush from Armored Saints sitting here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You are on the road to rock.
Hi, everyone. This is Eric Martin, the lead singer for the band Mr. Big, and you are on the road to rock with Clint Switzer.
Thank you so much, man. I love talking about the things that I love, Clint, and for you to allow me to do it with you. God bless you. God bless the Heartland. God bless America.
You are now on the road to rock. It's not just a podcast. It's an unabashed celebration of rock's living legends. And now, please welcome your host, the master of your rock and roll road trip, leading you down the highway to hell, Clint Switzer.
Some days, the world just seems to shine bright onto you, and that day is today here on the Road to Rock, and I hope it shines brightly onto each and every one of you as this week, for the second time, Dee Snider, yes, Twisted Sister frontman, and now, novelist Dee Snider is going to be joining me on this very show to talk about his latest book, Frats, which kind of examines a character named Bobby that moves to a different high school in the Long Island, New York area in the early 70s and encounters what Dee in the book refers to as frats, these gangs that have like taken over the school, and Bobby has to fight for his own survival, his relationships, and everything around him. In what is a fantastic book, Dee Snider, the Renaissance man, he kind of does it all. And we're so pleased to have him back on. It's been 2 years. I think it was since the release of his last solo album, which was in 2021. It was called Leave a Scar. Now Dee is back on the show once again to talk about Twisted Sister being inducted into the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame. That happened back in January. The idea of cancel culture and being a voice for the voiceless, as Dee Snider is a self-described moderate. So in this interview, he talks about being for logical gun control and the fact that he owns many guns. He shows us, if you're watching the YouTube version, go check that out at Starcade Media. Dee Snider shows us kind of some guns that are in the cabinet behind him. Dee Snider, there is no one like him. I remember back when I was in high school, I was such a Twisted Sister fan, and I didn't look to politicians to, you know, really formulate my view of the world. I looked to people that I looked up to, you know, athletes and musicians and rockers. And Dee Snider was so outspoken, and he had taken on Washington when it came to censorship. He sat there and went toe-to-toe with Tipper Gore. So that was my kind of guy. And my buddies and I would always say, what would Dee Snider do in this situation? And he's always been kind of a voice for the voiceless. We're going to talk about that and how if he feels pressure when doing that, when he interacts with people on Twitter, when he calls people out, he tells it like it is. There's nobody that pulls, that he does not pull punches. You know Dee Snider, you know he's uncancelable, as was mentioned in an interview he did last week with my good friend Chuck Shute from the Chuck Shute podcast, which is another fantastic interview with Dee. Go check that one out as well. But as we get going here into the month of June and the summer months here on the road to rock, it's always been my favorite time of year, the summertime. You're out there, you go to the lake, you go to the ocean, you go to the beach, you're out there doing road trips with your family, you're going to live shows. And for me, it seems like always the biggest and most memorable interviews for me a lot of times happen in the summertime. And here is Dee Snider as he's promoting his book, Frats, which I hope you go to dsnider.com and check it out. Check out the synopsis. Check out what people are saying about the book, which is getting great reviews, including a review from my good friend and Dee's good friend, Mick Foley, the hardcore legend himself, on Dee's website, gives a nice little synopsis and a little review that you can go check out. So go to dsnider.com, check out all the details. Dee always has irons in the fire. We're going to talk about Strangeland, a horror film ahead of its time. Could there be a sequel? And also, just who is Dee Snider's most influential person in his life? All that and much more are right here. And we can't thank you enough for being a part of On the Road to Rock. Like I said, 99% of the interviews we do are done on Zoom now. So that's a treat for our YouTube subscribers. If you want to check out this interview in video format, go to our YouTube channel and subscribe. Starcade Media, that brand is the umbrella to which everything we do falls under. StarcadeMedia.com and our website here, of course, for the podcast, RoadToRockPodcast.com, which, by the way, again, we're giving away tickets to Rocklahoma, two different sets of two, four total. Go to our Facebook page right now, facebook.com/RoadToRockPodcast, where you can enter to win. We got the contest pinned right there at the top for you. So all you have to do is go to the page and you can enter to win. This is going to go on all summer long because the party of the summer is coming up. Labor Day weekend in Pryor, Oklahoma. Bands like Godsmack, Limp Bizkit, Daughtry, Mammoth, Wolfgang Van Halen, heck, even Skid Row, Kix, Bush. There's so many more. Go to rocklahoma.com and get your weekend passes now before they sell out. It's going to be one of the biggest rock festivals in America, and it's happening Labor Day weekend in Pryor, Oklahoma. Funny enough, the first place I ever saw Twisted Sister was at Rocklahoma, the very first one in 2007. So bringing it all back around to our guest this week, which is Dee Snider, and that interview is coming up right now. It's great to have you back on the Road to Rock here, Dee Snider, sporting a little bit different background than the last time. I think last time you had like a digital skull thing behind you. What happened to that?
For some reason, the new Zoom doesn't, I haven't taken the time to update it, import my thing. So all you get is my cabinet, which, let's see, has a lot of stage clothes in there.
That is cool. Wow, that jacket's awesome.
And a lot of guns and books. And the other one, as my wife says, too many guns.
Well, that's okay. No judgment here, D. It's great to have you back, man. And I know you've been doing a lot of interviews. When you do projects, which is a lot, you do a lot of different things. You're a renaissance man. Let's just be honest. You hit the rounds. You make the rounds. You do the interviews. Do you like doing it? Do you enjoy just talking to the average rock dude like me, for instance? Is it fun for you at all?
I love talking about myself. So, my wife will attest to that. I try not to do too much of that around the house.
Glad to provide you that outlet then. So
no, but it's usually, you know, it's usually connected to, you know, latest project or album or movie or something. So, when you've worked on something for so long, it's hours, days, years at times, you know, it's exciting to get some feedback and to speak with people about it. So, yeah, I'm good with it.
Well, the book, of course, you've written your first novel. It's called Frats, and it is out now. And I have just started. I just got a copy like 2 days ago, so I'm just starting it. I think that you've always been a fascinating person to me with the way you talk, the way you connect with people, the way you write. In this case, I've read your autobiography, so this just is compelling to me. For one, just what was the impetus for this project? Where did this story kind of come from? What made you want to write a novel to begin with?
So that's a few questions. I'll answer them. And let's do this simplest one. Writing a novel, I've been writing since I co-created the Twisted videos, screenplays, stage plays, articles, you know, animated shows, all kinds of things. And I've written a couple of books before, but it was COVID. And I had an idea. It was going to be a screenplay, or I said, no, it's really kind of a book. I said, well, there was a good time to start a book, that kind of project. COVID was a good one. All that downtime, all that locked up time, you know. So that made me go to write a novel. So that was the first, but I'm pretty excited about that. But the subject matter came from my youth. I grew up in a town called Baldwin, which is the town on Long Island. And in the early 70s, it's a period piece based where I live, but it's not autobiographical. And but in that world, there were these gangs. They were called fraternities, high school fraternities, but they had charters and they were accepted by the schools, but they were basically just gangs walking around with Greek jackets on. And as a kid there, you grew up sort of knowing the minefield, the lay of the land. Don't go over here, stay away from that store, that's where you hang out. You know, oh, they're coming, we got to get out of here, that kind of thing. Because I'm one of those guys, big as I am, I was one of the weird guys. So, you know, I wasn't in one of the frats. But I knew the world, and that was my world. When I went on the road and started talking to people, and I mentioned high school fraternities to a man and woman, they were like, what's that? And I say, you didn't have high school fraternities? They go, no. So, and when I told them about how violent they were and the drugs and the alcohol and, you know, just what a issue they were to in the landscape of growing up, people were very intrigued. So I knew there was a story in there. But the story of Bratz came about when I, again, it's all based on actual facts, actual events, I should say. But I said, what would I lived there. I knew the lay of the land. What if you were transferred, came from another state in your senior year of high school and got plopped into this world that you don't know about? What would your reaction be? You know, since they don't have this elsewhere.
Right.
And my main character, Bobby Kovacs, pretty much the first day of school, he crosses the wrong guy for the right reasons. He was trying to help his friend out who was being bullied and winds up making an enemy out of one of the most dangerous people in the school. So his whole life changes in an instant just because he wanted to help a friend, and it starts spiraling out of control. And ultimately, to protect himself from this gang, he has to join a fraternity to protect himself. And it really, things go really from bad to worse for Bobby. There is a glimmer of hope at the end. So it's not a complete loss, but it gets pretty dark. And it's a study in how one moment in time can change our lives forever, you know, for the better or for the worse. And we've all probably had these moments, things where, you know, wow, if I didn't make that decision, you know, this great thing wouldn't have happened. Or, wow, I made that decision and it was not a good one and it changed my whole life.
And you got Johnny, our hero, going after the girl, which, you know, I heard in, as I listened to you with my good friend Chuck Shute on the Chuck Shute podcast, that maybe mirrored a little bit of your experience with your own wife, so to speak. And so there's elements of Dee Snider in this character of it Johnny.
One was a love interest. And so I'm like, what am I going to base his love story on? And my love story is pretty interesting with Suzette. So if people have read my autobiography, they'll recognize some of the, you know, going to Saw Sunday and being threatened with death by the mob family and all that stuff, which really
very,
happened.
Very common.
So I made Bobby's, you know, Bobby's life, romantic life, it parallels mine. The only other reference to me is in high school, I was in a band called Dusk, D-U-S-K. And we were like the popular band and we played all the dances and stuff. You know, that was the only time ever, like, the cool people in high school ever, like, related to me is when I was on stage with Dusk. And, hey, man, can you play, you know, Run, Run, Run by JoJo Gunn? All right. You know, that kind of thing. But in the book, there's a passing reference that at the prom, Dusk is playing. And Bobby, who's talking and looking at the past, he goes, yeah, the singer went on to become pretty famous. And that's the only passing reference because Baldwin was my town. In 1972, 73, I was in Dusk, and that was the band in high school.
I am much looking forward to seeing where Bobby Kovacs goes with his story. And obviously it's building to some pretty dark things, you know, some violent encounters, you know, just fighting through the brotherhoods, these self-proclaimed frats, which Dee, I got to ask, I guess, when I saw the title of the book, you automatically think like, oh, like college frats. I didn't really think about that as a high school reference. You know, and back in my day, it was like you had the jocks, the freaks, the nerds, like that kind of thing is what I thought of. So what frat, so to speak, did you belong to?
I did not belong to a frat. As a matter of fact, when you read the book, there will be the Bretts. The Bretts are these three guys that Bobby befriends early on when he first moved. He becomes friends with Brett and the nerdy, but they connect with comic books and heavy metal, rock and roll. And Bobby's more of a jock kind of guy, but he's a cool guy. Grew up on an Air Force base, so he kind of had an integrated environment where there's a lot more acceptance of people. And the Bretts sit in the lunchroom and they're the great observers of the fraternity world. They watch it all and they see it all, try to stay out of their way. I was one of the Bretts. I was the guy trying not to get my ass kicked by the fraternities. As a Brett, we saw what was going on. Like, they're great observers.
A lot of the, you know, a lot of the book publisher and a lot of the kind of marketing uses the term toxic masculinity. And Dee, this strikes me as a term that you would maybe not be a huge fan of. But so are you cool with that kind of being used in the marketing of the book?
It was funny because I wrote the book and I write it and I you know, with the publisher and they go, we love this. This is about toxic masculinity.
You're like,
it is. And I technically it is. It's about masculinity. It's about toxic. They're toxic, violent. You know, it's kind of, it's that thing that, you know, affects a lot of people. The ripple effects of that growing up in that environment go on for decades, you know? So, I mean, they, you know, it's a catchphrase that they can sink their teeth into. I just want to get my damn book published. And write about, you know, this microcosm. Like I said, it turned out, you said, you know, I only heard of college fraternities. I tell people, I said, what's the difference between a college fraternity and a high school fraternity? College fraternities played beer pong. College fraternities rumbled. Yeah. Everything was rumbles and fights. And they were, you know, they were a lot less, not the college fraternities are really mature, prepared, but high school were even less ready to deal with this, with that world. And it was very violent, you know? So see, for me, I remember, it's funny, I was just a big, weird guy. So I avoided a lot of problems because I was big and weird. But then, but I would say that, you know, you can't fight off everybody. And one day I was jumped by an entire fraternity because I used to wear a derby in high school. I was a weird, big, weird guy wearing a derby. And finally they got tired of the big, weird guy with the derby and the hair sticking out. They probably did everybody a favor and they jumped me and took my derby. But all it did for me was make me act out more. You know, so hence, you know, I went from a derby to full face of makeup and costumes and craziness. So, you know, someday if they left me with my derby, I might have just settled with that. But instead, I went down a very crazy path.
Well, you know, my dad is about your age and he went to high school during this exact time period. And he's told me a lot of stories about back in the day and he played football and how high school was and how the world was. And it seems like in a lot of ways that maybe things are worse in society today, but yet at the same time, obviously it's probably a good thing that we don't promote that there's not frats in schools and jumping people for wearing a derby and that we really are all in on inclusion and stuff like that. So do you feel like that maybe that in some ways it's better, but also in some ways it's also, you know, we've gone downhill since the 70s.
There's plenty of bullies out there and they've taken on different forms now, you know, interesting. There's gangs, there's places that, you know, they don't have high school fraternities, they've got gangs, and that's not unusual. And we're much more, it's a bully free zone, and we're much more attentive. Was it worse back in the 70s and 60s and 50s? I don't know. Is it just as bad today? I don't know. But it's weird, you know. For me, growing up in that aggression and with a very bullying dad, you know, as well, made me get tougher and stronger. And in many ways, I'm grateful to that I survived and I'm stronger for it. That said, there's many people that don't get stronger, they get weaker. Many people withdraw and it defines their personalities and, you know, and there's depression and suicide. Although I never, you know, back in the 70s, I never heard that anybody say the word depression. Or you know, I don't remember anybody committing suicide, you know, and now it's almost, I don't want to say go-to, that's a gross exaggeration, but certainly it's a regular occurrence, you know.
Yeah,
a regular occurrence, and depression is a major, major thing. So was it better? That's such a hard thing to say. Certainly nobody likes getting their ass kicked, you know, and certainly nobody likes getting their ass kicked. And it was a powerful story to write about because, again, it's a reflection on how small decisions can affect us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. And I sense a lot of kind of outsiders meets West Side Story involved here. And I've always been fascinated by those kind of worlds, and those stories really suck me in. And just as this one is doing, because you just have a way about you and an entertaining way that you are able to present these things. And I highly recommend the book Frats. I hope you go get it. Go to dsnyder.com and pick it up right now. Skip Amazon. They'll probably cut you out a few dollars on the rights there. So go to dsnyder.com.
Go to dsnyder.com. That's the easy one. Click on the link there. But it is available everywhere, you know, everywhere. They say everywhere good books are sold. So I don't know where the shitty books are sold, but the good books are sold where my books are being sold.
Well, my mom's an English teacher. She's for 30 years, she's got a whole gaggle of them up in her attic. So that's where they all reside. So no disrespect to her. D, 2023, believe it or not, was the year of Twisted Sister. Heavy Metal Hall of Fame. You guys go in this year. What a moment. I have to be honest. I think the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think that, hey, if we're living in an era of cancel culture, I'm just going to cancel the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They put Missy Elliott in. Iron Maiden is out. I'm done. But the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame puts in you, Raven, in the same year. And to me, that's the Hall of Fame I'm going with now forevermore.
You know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame could have saved itself a lot of problems by simply calling themselves the Music Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
I live from Long Island. There's a Long Island Music Hall of Fame. And in there is Arlo Guthrie and Neil Diamond and Twisted Sister and Zebra is in there and Public Enemies in there and, you know, and Kiss is in there. So, because it's music. And the minute you put that word on it, everybody's like, okay, I get it. It's a Music Hall of Fame. And these are great musicians. It's a success, you know. So, by calling it the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it positioned itself to criticism, and the people who run that thing, it's still the Jan Warners of Rolling Stone and the Meg Griffins from WNEW in New York City, like the hip radio station from the 70s and 60s. NEW has been off the air for decades. Get me the guy who started Stiff Records. These are the people who are the panel, the voting panel at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So these old mother effers are picking the stuff that they grew up with. They're old. Of course they're picking, you know, and they just, the minute they go and die, the sooner the better, guys and girls, the sooner the better. And they bring in some contemporary people. They'll either vote to change the name or they'll just start acknowledging fans. It, you know, to me, sales do matter. Being beloved does matter.
Yes.
And the amount of fans you have does matter. And they threw us a bone when they have the fans' choice. This way they can say, we didn't pick Kiss. We didn't pick Judas Priest. The fans, you know, and this, you know, the elitist mother effers, you know, so they've got it. Yeah. Now to the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame, this is in its formative years. It's about fifth year, you know, and people saying, but why isn't Metallica in there? Why isn't, you know, because they're not big enough yet. We've got to support the Heavy Metal Hall of Fame. We've got to, you know, got to champion it so it gets bigger. Because, yeah, heavy metal deserves its own Hall of Fame. It's important. You look at some of the greatest musicians in history. They come out of heavy metal. The greatest drummers, the greatest guitar players, the greatest bass players across the board. They come from the metal world.
And you were able to do a 20-minute set. Obviously, unfortunate that Eddie couldn't join you there. But aside from that, a good experience on stage with the guys one more time?
It was great. I mean, we're friends. That's one thing that came out of reuniting after the ugly breakup in the 80s was that we're now all friends and we love each other and just be with the guys. And, you know, it was a shame Eddie got COVID. And, unlike some people who might have, and there are people out there, said, you know, mum's the word. I'm just going to go down there and I'm not going to miss this opportunity. Eddie was kind enough to say, hey guys, you know, I tested positive and I can't do that to you. So his guitar tech was a great Keith War is a great player. And so many of these techs are, you know, Joey Kramer, stopped playing with Aerosmith and his drummer steps in, you know, it happens all the time, either that or a family member from steps in and takes over. But, you know, it was Raven was in there and we were in there and that was, you know, there was, great, but we got to keep supporting this important mission and get it to the point where, you know, the Maidens and the Metallicas are there with, and the Priests are there alongside of us as they should be, you know, but they all got, we got to support this.
And that maybe that there's a physical place that you can go, that you can tour and things like that. It would be wonderful to see it get to that. And
I used to do morning radio in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
1999, 2000, 2001, 3 years. And I floated the idea of a Heavy Metal Hall of Fame back then. And I remember being offered the prison in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the Indian Motorcycle and the Basketball Hall of Fame are. they were going to let us take the prison for the Metal Hall of Fame.
It's a good idea.
A converted prison? Wouldn't that be the best Metal Hall of Fame? That's great.
That needs to happen. We need to buy up that land and start in on that. Dee, when I think back on that, the run Twisted Sister had in its second phase, starting with New York Steel, reuniting, putting the costumes on, and ending at a show that I was at, Dee, at the Goldlands Pawn and Jewelry in South Dakota. I think I was at that show, which is unbelievable. I think about just how the band was positioned. And I think it was maybe one of the more genius things that a band has ever done, because you guys were rare. It was scarce. You'd see you at a big festival and they'd be like, oh my God, Twisted Sister's there. Poison toured every summer. Motley Crue signed a 10-year, $100 million deal with Live Nation all around this time. But you guys were rare. It was rare to see you. That positioning, I think, maybe really helped you guys. And that whole last 12 years or so was, a great time for the band.
It did. And you know, I'd love to say I realized the marketing was a project. No, I just didn't want to play that much, but it actually worked out for us because we would be headlining over bands that sold more records and were more popular than us. And the response was, yeah, but they weren't here last month. They weren't, nobody's seen them in 2 years in this area. So we would get great, you know, especially on the festival bills, we would be headliners. So much of the time, a great position, bigger than our actual level of record sales, because we weren't there like Poison every year or something like that, or every few weeks or whatever.
Well, it was, I'm glad I was a part of that last show in America. I know you did another show in Mexico, I think, right after that, but 40 and Fuck It, and now Heavy Metal Hall of Famers, and that is a wonderful legacy for Twisted Sister. I got to ask you about what I feel was one of the great horror movies of the 90s. It was Strangeland. And it's funny because every few years since it came out in like 97, there's been talk of, well, the production has started. There's going to be a part two. Captain Howdy's coming back. In hindsight, do you feel like that film was just way ahead of its time, especially with like all the online stuff? And I think it really like was almost a few years ahead of its time, and it came out in like 2002. It might have been a whole different story. And could there be was this part two ever to be?
So thank you for your compliments on the film. You know, it was ahead of its time. I reinvented the wheel back then. It was the first movie rated R for scenes of torture. It was the first torture film. You're welcome. And when I talked to the creators, Eli Roth and James Wan, the creators of Hostel and Saw, they bowed down before me, because it was what gave people the idea, like, oh, you mean people don't have to be dying and being chased all the time. They can be suffering, and they can be, which is what I realized, that suffering and being unable to run is scarier than being able to run. And you might get away, but when you're there and you're tied up and your mouth sewn shut and you have some guy effing with you, that's the most disturbing thing possible. So yeah, and it was greenlit immediately after the first one came out, and then the company that made the first one got indicted by the federal government, and all the property was seized.
Damn it!
Yeah, 7-8 years I was fighting to get my property back, and then it had a bunch of false starts when you said it was going with the production, and then it fell apart. So it's been one of the bane of my existence, trying to get Strangeland 2 made. And to that end, I've almost given up on it. And what I'm doing now is I wrote another scary movie called My Enemy's Enemy, which I'm supposed to be directing. Things are kind of put back due to all the strikes that are going on now with the Writers Guild and the, now it looks like the actors are going on.
Well, you could just write it too. Just write it and direct it.
That wasn't the tough part. That's already written. And now the part is with the problem is with the actors, because they're about to go on strike. And I'm in the Screen Actors Guild as well. So I'm hoping that I'm going to direct this movie. It's a totally different thing. Another movie based on actual events, but it's very disturbing, powerfully disturbing. It will reinvent the wheel again. And I'm hoping that maybe that'll lead me to the point where people will say, hey, that's great. Got anything else? And I say, yeah, I got this movie called Strangeland 2 that I've been wanting to make for a while. So I'm hoping I'll finally get to do that. So there's always hope.
Did you, you had obviously Robert Englund in that movie. Did you talk to him? Did you learn anything from him about just like taking on a character like Captain Howdy, how he did Freddy Krueger? And like, he was this Shakespearean actor that just found his way into this film and totally, you know, talk about reinventing the wheel of horror. Yeah. Like, did he talk to you at all?
Well, when Robert accepted the role of one of my victims, I was like stunned. I mean, it was just something very, you know, very powerful about the idea that this icon of horror is allowing me to be a victim of my character. But when we met, and now we've been friends for a while now, he just said, dude, this script is brilliant. And, you know, and he loved the script. And the script was actually, you know, I had a lot of problems with the director. I mean, people that you don't understand, but there was a lot of damage done in the filming process. We actually went into litigation with the director because he compromised the script so much. I had to cut so much out of the movie that would have made it an even better film. And it wasn't so much of the suffering and stuff. It was more storyline, you know, that everything made full sense and built properly. And it's a couple of people go, well, how did that happen all of a sudden? Well, that happened all of a sudden because we had to cut a whole section out of the movie because my stupid director screwed it up. But I got the people who were in the movie, there's some great people like Linda Cardellini.
Amy Smart.
I keep forgetting her name. The one who played the mother, she was an Oscar-nominated actress for Jacob's Ladder. I keep forgetting her name all the time. But she was, I had such great talent in the movie. Kevin Gage was from the movie Heat. He was with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. So, I mean, such great, talented people. And it's a cult classic. People like it. They refer to it. Hopefully, I'll get to do more with it someday in the future.
Well, I got to ask you about your buddy, Mick Foley. You guys always have seemed kind of attached at the hip in a lot of ways. You do a lot of charity work together. You appeared on his documentary about 10 years ago. And Mick has actually written a nice review here on your website for the book Frat. So obviously you guys have kept in touch. He's written a great review of your book. So what's been your relationship like with Mick lately?
What he says, read what he says. Go ahead, read it.
Oh, I got it right here. It, where'd it go? Yeah. It's about frats. There it is. Oh, there's the, what readers are saying. Mick Foley here says, first time novelist D. Snyder has a winner on his hands with frats. Snyder's ability to create characters readers can both relate to and root for is the difference between simply reading a book and truly enjoying that book. I finished the bulk of the book in just two sittings. He's already got me beat on that one. Damn it, Mick. And then did my very best to prolong those last several pages, not wanting the experience to end.
Wow. No, it's only about 200 page book. So it's not like a tome, you know, but yeah, that was one of the most flattering things. I've heard that multiple times. People like, I didn't want it to end. So I stopped reading and came back to it, but to savor it ending. And so that's great praise. And Mick, he's a friend and an inspiration. He's one of the people that, you know, so many things. He got me doing charity work. He's such a charitable guy, and he's the one who introduced me to giving back and how important it is. I talk about Mick a lot in my memoirs as well. And then as far as the writing goes, he's one who inspired me to try and write my own book. He was writing his own books. He's a great writer.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd been writing screenplays, but when it came to my memoirs, he said, look, you're going to get pushback from the publishers. He said, ask them if you can just write a few chapters. If they don't like it, tell them you'll accept having a co-writer. And he said, that's what I did. And I did that exact thing, took my lesson from Mick, and I sent my few chapters, and they wrote back, and he said, it's great, write your book. So that was the first time I wrote a complete book by myself, and now Frats is my second attempt. First at writing a novel, but it's a second book.
Mick's a good person to consult with that. Former New York Times bestselling author and all around good guy, as are you, D. I got to ask you about some of the interactions, because you are on Twitter. You're somebody that you fire back at people. You say what's on your mind. That's what I've always respected about you. When I was growing up, when a lot of people like me that didn't know who to vote for, my family wasn't very political. I was from a small town. I didn't really know who voted for who. So you kind of became a voice for people like me. Is there a pressure there to kind of being a voice for the voiceless? Cause I feel like I'm one of the voiceless that isn't some crazy either way, right or left person that I somehow exist in the middle, but yet I feel like there's no place for me in the world. You kind of take that on for a lot of people.
Wow. That's really flattering and observant. And yeah, I kind of feel like that's my job now. You know, I'm just, we're not going to take it. I'm the guy who who spoke out and continue to speak out when others don't. Too often, the true majority remains silent because, you know, we don't have the hard opinions of the left or the right, extreme left and right. And they're so loud and they're screaming there all the time. And, you know, we're all just trying to make sense of the world. We're just trying to figure it out, man. And, you know, as I said, it's a vast moderate, the vast space of moderates. And people say, well, what's a moderate, D? Is there a moderate? Yeah, there's a moderate. What's a moderate? If you're on the extreme right or extreme left, or if you're on the right or left, but you're willing to compromise or negotiate, you are a moderate. Because the extremists on the right and the left, they're unwilling to give one inch. I just ran into it head with the LGBTQIA plus community.
Yep.
Because I disagreed with a thing that they said out of the thousands of things I support. One thing, and I was like, transphobic. I'm like, and I do not suffer that shit easily. Because most people, you know, Paul Stanley was like, I'm sorry. RuPaul was like, I'm sorry, I misspoke. I was like, no, I'm not sorry. I didn't say anything wrong. I support you guys. I believe in you guys, but I don't agree with everything you say. And you're not going to pressure me to agree with every single thing you
sure.
say. And that's where, and this is a Facebook post that people, if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm sure you saw it, you know. And I said, I said, you know, hey, I own a Hummer and I own a Tesla. I own too many guns and I am for intelligent gun control. I have too many kids and I'm for a woman's right to choose. I ride a motorcycle and I'm an environmentalist. They're not mutually exclusive. This idea that it's all or nothing. You got to get that off the table. And the people who are in the middle got to realize, yeah, I'm, you know, I lean to the right or yeah, I lean to the left. But I think this is room for a conversation. If you feel that way, join the D's of the world, please. Join the D's. And if you don't, you know, someone said to me exactly what you said. Hey, I don't have the platform. I don't have the voice. I don't have that personality to be at the forefront. I said, well, find somebody that's speaking your language and get behind them because we need to feel supported as well. Get behind me because I need to feel like I'm not the only one out there. I felt a bit like that in 85 in Washington.
Yeah.
I came home, I felt a little bit like, where was everybody when I was there standing up? And, you know, and people weren't outspoken enough at that time, you know? So we have to speak up. And a lot of people asked me to run for office. And I, you know, one person that I got a call from a Lincoln, you know, that Lincoln Project, the Republicans who have abandoned the Republican Party, and said, I don't want to take no for an answer. We started a super PAC in your name. You're running for office. And I said, thank you. I don't want the job. I appreciate how passionate you are to have me as a voice and that you respect me. But I've seen these people. These people in Washington are not good people. My dad, 92-year-old dad, put it very well. He said, they'll say anything to get elected, and they'll say anything to not be kicked out, to not be voted out. And he said, and they're not about what's right or what's wrong. It's about their own interests. And I'm sorry, I don't want to deal with those people, you know?
Yeah, well, it's my friends and I had a saying when we were, you know, high school age or something. It was always, what would Dee Snider do? Because we all went to church, we had the WWJD going on, but I would always say, what would Dee Snider do? And that, you know, that
I'm glad you were very observing because I was... You know, everything I stood for back then, I still stand for now. I'm disappointed
with
so many of my peers to hear them talk. And a lot of them have become super conservative and super right wing. And I say, that's all because they have money. You know, all of a sudden they were like, I'm a struggling artist. Yeah, social, you know, take advantage of what's out there. You know, and all of a sudden now we're rich. We're like, yeah, you know, F those people.
Well,
you forget too quickly. You can't forget, even if you are successful, you've got to always remember what it felt like when you were on the other side, when you were
certainly. Yeah. And I love that. I hope we can find a way here in this crazy world. I'll tell you one thing I'd like is when my worlds collide, and that happened in 2021 in season 3 of Cobra Kai, as I'm a huge fan of that show, huge fan of the Karate Kid. And Dee Snider is performing for Billy Zabka and Miguel in the show. What was that like being on that show and just your interactions? And it was shot at an actual Dee Snider show. How did it all happen?
It's crazy. So I met Billy and Ralph. doing conventions. You know, I do a lot of signings and appearances, you know, and they're there. And Billy, when I met him, it was very much between the heights of Karate Kid and the height of Cobra Kai. His star wasn't that bright. But I'm not about that. I'm about people. And me and Billy hit it off, and we really connected. And everything, we'd see each other often. So then one day, and I remember him telling me, he said, yeah, there's some, the YouTube's going to do something. This is before it started.
Right.
And a show called Cobra Kai. And YouTube wasn't like a thing, not for that. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Good luck with that. You know, YouTube show. So he calls me, and a couple years later, he goes, hey, Netflix is picking up Cobra Kai. And it would relaunch the whole thing. What do you think? Now, mind you, it's before it gets launched, because it takes a long time to get these shows made. He goes, what do you think about being on the show? We got this thing, and you come and you play. And I was like, you know what? Awesome. You know, hang out with you, hang out with Ralph. You know, but it wasn't a show. It wasn't like I was doing this big show. But when we got there, my wife is a makeup and hair person. You know, she said, this is sure. A big production. She said, this is, I'm putting a lot of money into the show. I'd never seen the show. I knew nothing about it. I'm at the backstage where we're going to go out. It was all staged in Atlanta. And this kid in a wheelchair pulls up. Like, hey, you know, this is Miguel. What's going on? And he's going to start tapping his toe. All right. You know, no clue. Go do the show. And then COVID hits. The show's released. The binge watching. It became the show. And suddenly I am launched into the zip, guys. You know, Cobra Kai, never die. Everybody's like freaking out. All these young kids are walking down the street, and young kids who would know who that old guy is, all of a sudden, that's Dee Snider, the most badass. That's going to be on my tombstone, but the most badass rocker of all time ever on my tombstone. So it says, you know, Johnny.
Billy Zabka, man. That is tremendous.
And it just blew up. So it was, yeah. And just, you like to say, oh, yeah, I knew there was going to be a big show. That's why. No, I just said, oh, yeah, hang out with my friend for a weekend.
Tremendous stuff. D, it is always an honor. I tell you what, right before we cut you loose, I got to ask you one question from our Facebook page, because Shaggy Shane, one of the biggest Twisted Sister fans I know, has one simple question for you, and I actually don't know the answer to this, so I'm going to ask it. He simply asked, what person in your life had the biggest impact on you, was your biggest influence? I guess that could be music related or just in life.
Wow. There's been, you know, and I reflect, it actually brings me back to the book, because you talk about this book, and we talked about it already, is Bobby moves to this town and makes one mistake, changed his life forever. And for the worse. Well, I had a similar mistake. And that's what I based it off of. It was in sixth grade. I moved to town in sixth grade. And I came from a school where I was a pretty cool guy and popular and blah, 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 and, you know, badass, whatever. And sixth grade, you know, fifth grade going into sixth grade. And the first day of school, I pick a fight with, unbeknownst to me, the toughest guy in the school.
Oh, shoot.
The guy was left back like two times. He had these deformed fingers, because he had actually lifted in fifth grade at 11 a manhole cover off of a sewer, and putting it back, he crushed his own fingers. So I didn't know, and I picked a fight with Hammy Hamburger. The Hamburger. Is that the one? Hamburger. Pick him Hammy. And, you know, Hamburger outside, and people are like, holy crap, the new guy's going to fight Hammy. And I'm thinking, I'm a tough guy. In the fight, in front of the whole school, Hanny picked me up into the air and threw me through the air into the building. Now, mind you, that moment in time, you say, what a weird thing to pick. If I had beat Hanny Hamburger, I would have been the popular guy, going to all the parties, getting all the girls. But instead, I was the unpopular doofus who was home, listening to my records, practicing my art, practicing my craft. If I had won that fight, I would not be the rocker that I became.
Wow.
Not have the life I had. I would have gone down a whole different path of popularity. And popular kids don't spend time in the bedroom practicing their craft. They don't spend time painting or writing. They're too busy having a good time. Okay. Dude, anytime I meet like a really handsome I was gonna say, are you okay time wise? Because I'm okay. I came in 15 minutes late. I anytime I run into a handsome musician, truly handsome, I did this to John Sykes. John Sykes. So we're playing with Whitesnake. This is when he was with Thin Lizzy. Thin Lizzy, we're over Monsters of Rock in Europe. And I see John Sykes. The man is fashion, has fashion model, good looks. He's gorgeous. I come walking in. He's never met me. I walk right up to his face. I put my nose on his nose. He's never met me. I go, what is it like? Looking like you.
That's amazing, D. Cannot thank you enough for joining us here on The Road to Rock, my friend. Best of luck. And I certainly hope everything goes well with the book. It's called Frats and it's tremendous. So really appreciate you being on the show, my friend. The Zoom meeting cut off right at the end with D. So we missed the stereotypical goodbye there. Just had like 30 seconds to go and it just cut off right at the end. I was trying to get it upgraded and we usually do everything in under 40 minutes, but D is so good that it was going on. I was trying to upgrade it while I was on the meeting with D and it just cut off right at the end. But you heard that great story there for my good friend, Shaggy Shane Williams, and my Starcade Media brethren, who's also a huge Twisted Sister fan. So certainly hope that Shane and all the On the Road to Rock listeners or viewers enjoyed that interview as much as I did with D. Snyder. Again, our website, roadtorockpodcast.com, and the YouTube channel. If you want to check out the video, it is Starcade Media. Go subscribe today because 99% of the interviews we do are on video and you get it right there. D's right up in your face. So go check that out. Really appreciate you for being on The Road to Rock. And I know that a lot of you are on The Road to Rock all summer long, that it's time for the road trips, the family trips, the lake, the outdoors, the adult beverages, the live shows. That's what it's all about. Because in the summertime, anything is possible. That's what I always loved about it. There's no regrets. And even dating back of whenever I was a kid, that, you know, you knew that when school was out, that you had 3 months of whatever you wanted to do ahead. Now, a lot of people wind up more busy in the summer than they did during school, whether you get a job or you're doing camps or whatever you're doing. But it's still, there is something about it, something that's almost intangible that summer represents. And that's what we like to sort of harness that here on The Road to Rock. Because so much of what I do involves being out there on the road, going to events, going to shows, doing interviews in person, which I always love to do. And in this case, to have Dee join me via Zoom, it was a true pleasure. Once again, it's one of those things that when I started this podcast back in, 2013, that I could never have imagined that artists like Dee Snyder would be on this show. I think we started off really strong with Mike Trant from White Lion, and then very soon after that, Jeff Pilson from Foreigner / Dokken. So started off with a bang, and that's what this started off as, just wanting to relate to these artists that have shaped my life so much and to hear their stories and to help them promote things and to just be in that world with them. That's how this started, just as a passion. And, you know, this is one, not the first, but one of the first kind of interview podcasts in that format. Obviously, there was guys like Mitch LaFon doing it. Eddie Trunk's been out there doing it. Guys like Jeremy White, there was other shows. This was certainly not the very first rock and roll podcast. Decibel Geek, which is tremendous. They've been around forever. Michael Brandvold, there's a ton. But as far as this kind of format with a lot of the artists that we had on early on, a lot of members from a lot of 80s bands, even some of the unheralded ones like Babylon AD and Wildside and things like that, to find a voice and to find a way onto this podcast. And now to see here in 2023 that Dee Snyder is making a second appearance. That says a lot about the viewers, the listeners of this show, and how much you've supported it over the years. Cannot thank you enough for that. Cannot thank you enough for being here on The Road to Rock as we do this thing all summer long. You're here for it. And I thank you very much for that. We'll be back next week as we're knocking out some major interviews over the next couple weeks. Keep it coming and keep it right here on The Road to Rock.